Hello and welcome to another episode of Consumer, the European podcast of the Consumer Choice Centre. I'm your host, Bill Wirtz, on this January 28, 2021. Those with fine-tuned hearing will know that I'm in a different location. I'm currently in Istanbul, Turkey, where there's full lockdowns during the weekend and partial lockdowns during weekdays. It's not so fun, so I hope life is better wherever you're listening. Turkey is also the issue of this week's interview. My guest is Nazlıcan Kanmaz, Global Trainings Manager at Students for Liberty, and Turkish herself, who will be talking about new taxes on electronics in Turkey and how it influences the living quality of people who live in this country. Also in this episode, two more interviews with previous guests of the show, so get ready for breaking news and familiar voices. So let's dive right into it. First, a new impact assessment by the European Commission underlines the importance of the planned EU-Mercosur trade agreement. So the EU has been planning a free trade agreement between the EU and Mercosur for quite some time. Mercosur is the South American trade bloc compiled of Argentina, Brazil, Paraguay, and Uruguay. Here's Euromonitor explaining some of the benefits of this agreement.
Once ratified, the EU-Mercosur agreement will account for about 25% of the world's global economy. The trade agreement aims to eliminate tariffs for 90% of the products currently traded between the two economic blocs, and will eventually trigger fair but fierce competition. The matured and saturated markets of the EU will gain access to the fast-growing economies in Latin America, and Mercosur countries will gain access to highly competitive but large global markets in the EU. The global economy is going through turbulence, and increased protective measures on trade have been introduced because of this. However, this free trade agreement is an important movement in the opposite direction.
This agreement is also an opportunity to counter the growing influence of China in South America. Since 2005, the Chinese Development Bank and the Chinese Import-Export Bank have provided more than $141 billion in loans to Latin American and Caribbean countries and state-owned firms. $96 billion for energy, $25 for infrastructure. Brazil got $28 billion, Argentina almost $17 billion. Right now, China is already a more important trading partner for South America than Europe is, which has not only economic but also political consequences. Outside of these economic and political goals, we should also look at this agreement from a consumer choice perspective. I like Argentinian beef, and why exactly should I pay a fortune to have it? Here's some more context from a Euronews report from back in 2019.
Seven countries, including Germany and Spain, have written to Brussels asking for the deal to be sealed as soon as possible. But France and Poland want more measures to protect their rural economy. The deal would include services and public procurement, as well as products like sugar, orange juice and rice. And the EU-Brazil Association wants it to go even further into the digital sector.
Why we don't have a common strategy on artificial intelligence? Europe has just presented its own strategy. Why don't we work together? Why we don't create a common area for cloud services? I would like very much to see more cooperation in the startup, high-tech startup area. And these kind of things are even more important than how much beef you export.
But first, the EU hopes to sell more cars and car parts, as well as pharmaceuticals and chemicals, to 270 million consumers. Wine and dairy too. For the EU institutions, this is about fighting protectionism by delivering fairer trade deals.
French beef farmers are upset that there's rising competition, and the EU's impact assessment does lay out that as more beef will be imported to the EU, competition will rise. But other opportunities also do arise. This is Politico reporting, and I quote, "A draft of the analysis updates a study of the economic impacts of free trade agreements from 2016 by parsing the effects of current EU agreements with 12 new partners, Australia, Canada, Chile, Indonesia, Japan, Mercosur, Mexico, Malaysia, New Zealand, the Philippines, Thailand, and Vietnam. By 2030, these are cumulatively projected to supply 35% of the EU's imports and to be the destination for 12% of EU exports." End of quote. It also says that there will be great opportunities for European dairy, pork meat, wheat, wine, beverages, and processed foods. This comes down to the standard argument on protectionism. If South American imports hurt some sectors in our economy and we are worried about it, why not worry similarly about our own European neighbors? For instance, Germany makes good cars, and I'm certainly not buying a Renault. So why should France not protect Renault from German competition? Poland makes cheaper meat than Italy, so why not protect Italian meat producers from Polish competition? Well, we got rid of this protection because we realized that we are all better off if we trade between each other and utilize the opportunities we can present towards each other. Yes, that means that some sectors do face competition, but new ones also arise. Governments shouldn't be the arbiter of which sector deserves opportunities. It's for consumers to decide. EU-Mercosur is a great trade deal, and the EU should approve it. In other news then, Mastercard has announced that it wants to charge businesses higher fees when trading with companies in the EU, which could mean that retailers will charge higher prices for all types of goods. So I'm bringing back Fred Roeder, Managing Director of the Consumer Choice Center, who you will remember from episode 2 when we talked about the EU's farmer strategy and the European Green Deal. I asked Fred how it is possible that these fees are now suddenly exploding.
So in order to understand this very complex system, how credit cards charge points of sales, which is, for instance, your supermarket, if you swipe your credit card buying some apples in a supermarket or your debit card, there is something credit card companies charge shops, online and brick and mortar shops, when you use your card. These charges are called interchange fees. And about 6-7 years ago, there was a big debate in the European Union that these fees are too high. They were sometimes 1.5%. And there was a push to cap these fees at 0.3%. That was done back then. I actually opposed this measure. While I think that credit card companies charge sometimes outrageous fees, both sometimes to their customers, like the end users, the credit card owners, and the points of sale, they charge often too much. But at the same time, I would say there's a better way of fixing this than limiting the amount of money credit card companies can charge. So let's first look what has happened now with Brexit. The UK does not have to apply this European Union cap of 0.3% anymore. And Mastercard, one of the big credit card companies, moved very quickly and said, we're now going to charge 1.3% or 1.5%, depending a bit if it's a debit card or credit card, for UK cards being used in Europe. One can criticize Mastercard for doing that, because it seems that they basically want to go for a quick, profitable move. On the other hand, we need to actually look at this entire space of payment providers. There are only a handful of credit card companies. There's Mastercard, there's Visa, and there's American Express, and it's more or less it in Europe. I've never seen a Diners card in Europe. So the problem of we want to solve is having more competition and more innovation and payment solutions. And instead of capping the fees, we should rather looking at, okay, how can we allow more competition and more innovative startups going into this? How can we make the payment process and this credit card companies billing their customers and their points of sales, how can we bring in more competition there to make it cheaper? Because Bill, if you and I want to start a credit card company tomorrow and compete, we probably would have to raise tens, if not hundreds of millions of euros just to navigate the regulatory and legal environment of this. So if the UK wants to be smart on this and provide consumers more value, they should just allow more innovation and more competition in that sphere. And that's only possible if you lower the entry barrier levels to make it easier for companies to compete in this area, competing for customers by making these fees more affordable.
As a reaction to what just happened, of course, people in the European Union could say, well, it's great that the European Union is protecting us, because essentially that means that, you know, we're not charged with these fees. When it comes to competition, the problem of competition is, how do you solve the problem of the cross-border use? Because, you know, in some countries, when you travel around the world, you see some local debit and credit versions, but then they're not of much use internationally. How do you fix that problem? Because, you know, you can find a UK solution, but how can UK citizens then use these cards, these new innovations with low fees abroad? How is there a way to bridge this regulatory gap?
Yes, I mean, my suggestion would be to find some regulatory harmonization across the world, but on a very, very smallest common denominator. Just make it very easy to have a global payment system. You can see, for instance, the emergence of cryptocurrencies shows there are global currencies. they're not really regulated. That's why they're called crypto. Or it's hard to regulate them, but it's really easy for people to pay and receive, especially in very regulated countries or in authoritarian regimes. If you look at Venezuela or Argentina, it's actually a really good solution for people, like, to send remittances and not paying 80 euros to Western Union to send 80 euros, right? But on the other hand, also, when we look at this cap of interchange fees, I mean, I remember that my credit card company suddenly started charging me more. I got less bonus points using my card. I got less perks. So it's not that it's just like, that's not just being forwarded to consumer. Actually, what happened with this interchange fees is that the margins of retail shops increased. It's not that supermarkets started cutting your bill by 1.2% because you kept paying by credit cards. It's just like that margin stayed with the retailer, right? So it's portrayed as a pro-consumer move, but at the end of the day, it's like between the margins of retail and payment processor. And consumers actually were de-incentivized to use credit cards since these fees have been kept. Again, 1.5% seems to be outrageous high for just providing a payment. But the answer to that is more competition. If I pay with something with Ethereum or Bitcoin or Ripple, I'm not being charged so much, right? So we need to have like more competition globally, but also locally on alternative payment solutions. And probably a national solution such as the Belgian Bankcontact or something like this is not where we want to go.
Thanks, Fred, for being on the show. You can follow him on at Fred Cyrus Roeder. That's FredCyrusRoeder. In other news then, the EU's beating cancer plan has been leaked. Back in episode 3, we talked about this plan in detail and a European Parliament committee hearing where many parliamentarians had good things to say about e-cigarettes as a means to get people to stop smoking. But it seems that some of the good input was not taken into account by the European Commission. So I'm bringing back Michael Landl from the World Vapors Alliance to explain to us what's going on here.
So basically, the European Union wants to come up with a holistic plan how to beat cancer in the European Union. And obviously one very important part is the fight against smoking-induced cancer. So each branch of the European Union will come up with their own draft plan. And now the European Commission's draft got leaked yesterday. And the section about fighting smoking and also the proposals on vaping are very concerning. So basically, what we see, unfortunately, very often with the EU commissions, they are equating vaping with smoking and want to extend more or less the same regulations from smoking to vaping. So basically, the draft at the moment says that flavor bans should be implemented, that taxes should be increased on vaping, and it could be a ban on vaping in public spaces, more or less where it applies to smoking too. So that's obviously very concerning because, as we all know, vaping is not smoking. It's proven to be 95% less harmful. And I think if the EU truly wants to fight cancer and especially the smoking-induced cancers, it should endorse vaping instead of fighting it and make it less appealing for current smokers.
So let me just understand where we are in the process. So you were just explaining this is the draft by the Commission. Because I remember when last time we talked about the committee hearing in the European Parliament, and there I heard a lot of positive input. What do you think is going to happen? Is there going to be like some conflict between the Commission and the Parliament here on this issue?
To be honest, I hope so, because I hope the Parliament and some of the MEPs will fight back against this proposals. I mean, we have to see what the final version of the EU Commission's beating cancer plan will be. They will present it on February 3rd. But after this leak, I'm quite pessimistic that there will be many changes to the current version. So my hope is for the EU Parliament to fighting back against it, because as you said, we hearing out of there some more positive voices, and it's already confirmed vaping will be included. So we hope that it will be in a more positive way, and that the MEPs actively encourage current smokers to switch to the less harmful alternative of vaping. But we will see the Parliament plans to present their draft this year. We are not sure yet when that will be. And after they presented their draft, there will be negotiations with the EU Commission about the final beating cancer plan.
So ultimately, Michael, if the European Union mandates that buying vape products, e-liquids, e-cigarettes in general, and where you can consume them becomes more difficult, what do you think is the immediate consequence of that? What are consumers of current vaping products like you going to do?
I mean, basically, if that would go through like they propose it, the future of vaping in Europe looks pretty bleak. Because if you think about the three main points they make, if there would be a full flavor ban, it would take away a key instrument which makes vaping so successful, because the majority of adult vapers are using flavors exactly for the reason that they don't taste like cigarettes and keep them off the cigarettes. It's quite logic if they increase taxes on it and make it more expensive, that it's also less appealing for current vapers, but also for switchers, because the price is a key element. Up to now, it's cheaper than smoking. So many people also switch due to this reason. And it's also socially quite questionable, because the highest smoking rates are in low-income brackets of the society. So it's a strike against low-income households too. And obviously also if you increase smoking or vaping bans in public, it makes it also less appealing. So basically all three proposals are very harsh regulations, and which would be a huge blow for consumers, limited choice, increases prices. So basically the worst of the worst which could happen.
You can check out World Vapers Alliance on Twitter at @vapers_alliance, and also check out many of the policy papers that Michael Landl has written with the Consumer Choice Center under the publications page of consumerchoicecenter.org. Now let's move on to the main interview guest of this week. Nazarjan Kanmaz is the Global Trainings Manager at Students for Liberty, a student movement promoting the ideas of individual liberty and free markets. Nazarjan lives in Istanbul, which is in Turkey, and where she's from herself. We're diving into new taxes that the Turkish government has introduced on electronics, but also on new cars. So when I'm here in Turkey, I notice that you just go into your average Apple store and prices are much higher here. Why exactly is that? Why are many electronic goods in Turkey much more expensive than in the US or in Europe?
The taxes here are incredibly high. For instance, when you're buying an iPhone in Turkey, it costs around 15,000 liras, which is 1,680 euros. So if you go to a US Apple store, the same would be around 1,000 euros. So what is the difference between 1,000 euros and almost 1,700 euros? What's the difference there? And the difference there is just taxes. So Turkish government taxes their middle class much more than any other country, because the revenues for their taxes are very low. So they're trying to tax it from your luxury goods. So they started this tax around 2002 called special consumption tax. And that was introduced as part of the European Copenhagen criteria for the redistribution of social benefits through use of luxury goods. But since 2002, the definition of luxury goods has changed quite a bit. So now iPhone is a luxury good as well as soda drinks.
So give us some other examples as to what other goods are changing in price here. You know, look, for instance, there's this new PlayStation, and PlayStation is very popular, even sold out in a couple of countries in Europe. I guess not selling out in Turkey, because if there's a silver lining here as to, like, you know, if there's a bottom line as to, like, the price being significantly higher, how do these other products compare in price?
So the thing that affects the prices in Turkey, especially for tech goods, is One, it's the currency problem. The second is the taxes. So Turkey has been in a constant currency crisis since, well, 2018, I suppose. And it keeps going down and down. So last year, Turkish lira lost 30% of its value, even during the pandemic and with all the aids from the EU and the WHO and everything. On top of that, government is trying to combat this problem by raising taxes. So this might be helping for the government's cause, but it's making it much, much worse for the people, for the consumers. So, for instance, if you look at the price of PlayStation 5 that just released this year, it's 499 euros. But in Turkey, it's 13,279 liras, which is around 1,500 euros. So the difference, again, is huge, and you pay three times the price in Turkey for the same good. And in Turkey, it's already very expensive to buy this anyway. So if you're a minimum wage worker, you need to work for 5 months straight without spending any money on your salary to be able to buy a PlayStation 5.
But why don't people, you know, if the iPhone is so expensive here in Turkey, why don't I just, you know, I travel to Germany on like a little trip, I buy the iPhone there and I bring it back. Why can't I do that?
Well, that's actually a good question, because in terms of especially smartphones, the government is actually very savvy. Because if you buy a phone from abroad and wanted to use it in Turkey, you have to pay a special type of tax, which is, it just doesn't even feel like tax anymore. It's just the money they're asking for you to be able to use it. And it is raised 10% in 2021. And right now it is 2,100 liras, which is around 250 euros. And that is only for you to be able to use it in Turkey. So you might ask, what happens if I just don't pay it? They, of course, found a way to block your usage of this, or like not being able to use it. So when you put a Turkish SIM card on this phone, they immediately detect your IMEI number, which is basically the ID number of a phone. So that's encoded in it. And as soon as you use a Turkish SIM card, they find this number and they block this number. So you won't be able to use a phone in 3 months. So you have to either pay the tax for extra 250 euros, or you need to buy it in Turkey.
Well, it's not a very innovation-based kind of policy. This must really hurt young people. I mean, it's especially young people that, you know, use a lot of new electronic devices. But, you know, we're getting to a point where the older population is also affected by this, because we always talk about smartphones as if not everyone's using them at this point. But people must be really upset by these measures. Has there been no vocal opposition against it?
Yes, of course, there's a vocal opposition, especially for video game consoles. They raised the taxes by 50% since the beginning of the pandemic. So that was a very conscious decision from the government to hit a certain part of population, which is mostly the young people, millennials, like we can say. People are very enraged and people are very upset. But Turkish people's economic situation, they're purchasing power has been melting away year by year. So at this point, I think everybody's kind of tired to talk about any of these issues. They're just trying to get by with their minimum wage, sometimes even less than that. So what happens is that when you're buying an imported good, which is most of the times is a tech goods, you pay VAT, as usual, it's 18% in Turkey, and then you pay special consumption tax, which is varies between different goods. And then you pay special consumption tax off your VAT. So on top of that, they keep adding taxes of taxes. And then they add customs taxes. And then you pay special consumption tax over the custom tax as well. So they keep adding things on top of every tax. Even though they don't announce any new taxes, they keep adding taxes over taxes. So that's how they keep the prices rising.
Why can't I just get my Turkish iPhone and my Turkish PlayStation? Is there no competition here on the market? Because usually we know when we in Europe have protectionism, it's because we have our own products and we want to protect them from, you know, the imports. But how is it here in Turkey?
Well, I can clearly tell you that there's no Turkish PlayStation, But some companies, some Turkish companies, tried to use this opportunity to bring their own smartphones. But we know that for a fact that you, if you go through the specs of these phones, you see that they are made in China. They just put their names on it and sell it as Turkish phones. So they're using this opportunity to sell cheaper Chinese phones here to make revenues, while other big competitors like iPhone and Samsung are being hurt by this, all of these taxes and regulations.
And it's not just electronics. You were also mentioning, I've heard you mentioned cars. Buying new cars is also heavily taxed here in Turkey. Can you just explain what the consequences have been through these new taxes?
Right. So the special consumption tax was introduced for luxury goods, and cars were part of that. It has always been. But what happens now is that they keep raising these taxes to a degree that, for instance, if you're buying a car for 10,000 euros, what you need to pay for taxes is three times the amount the car costs. So yes, when you buy a car from the car dealership, for instance, you pay 40,000 euros, but the actual price of the car is 10,000 euros. Given that most of those cars are imported into Turkey, they're also dealing with the currency crisis much worse, because you might buy an iPhone with getting some money from your parents, maybe, but buying a car is so much more expensive. So most people are going to the secondhand cars, and the secondhand car market is roaring every year. So, for instance, they introduced another raise for the special consumption tax during the pandemic. And in one day, the same cars cost 10% more overnight, even though there's nothing has changed. It's only that they introduced taxes, and secondhand cars are getting more and more expensive as well.
The Turkish government is in a crisis of trying to raise revenue, and Turkish consumers are constantly hit by, you know, inflation and all of these taxes on new products. Do you see any solution out of here? Because it seems to be that the government is in this feedback loop of raising more taxes and just finding the product that they can tax next. What is an effective short-term solution that you see to get out of this situation?
I don't see a very easy way out for Turkey, especially economically in the short term. But what we have seen is a couple of months ago is, I think, interesting, because the son-in-law of Erdogan, who's also the economics and finance minister of Turkey, disappeared one day, and we still don't know where he is. But since his disappearance, Turkish lira is doing so much better. Turkey's economic problem is not about economics, but it's mostly about its governance. So even no governance is better than Turkish governance, especially when it comes to Turkish lira. That's what we see with the disappearance of the minister, and Turkish lira doing much better. So I think everybody keeps talking about this, but I think the solution would be actual reforms in the way the Turkish government works, because there are bigger problems that causes the economic problem and economic crisis in Turkey that is not necessarily economic.
And that concludes this very interview-based episode of Consumer. Thank you so much for listening. My name is Bill Wirtz. You can follow me on Twitter at WirtzBill, that's W-I-R-T-Z Bill. And of course, follow Consumer Choice Center at Consumer Choice C. Thanks for tuning in. See you Thursday.